Hello, and welcome to this fabulous Monday. I'm Amy Toy, and this is Angel Answers. And I am very privileged to have a special guest who I'll introduce in just a moment. Our topic will be on addictions. The animal psychic that I told you about will be on next week. We had to do some scheduling arranging. And that brings me to some of the topics that we're going to be covering. The first week in June, of course, we're going to have our Archangel of the Month. And then our second week, we're going to have Kathy Frankowicz. She does myofascial release. And then Maria Kramer is going to be doing integrated energy therapy on the 18th of June. So we've got some wonderful guests planned for you, so I look forward to that. And today we're going to discuss a very hard-hitting topic. It's addictions, and we're going to be covering, you know, every addiction. Betty Ann Marcoux is very good at, she used to be a former addictions counselor, and she worked for the government in Canada for a long time. And she has graciously volunteered the next 50, 55 minutes of her time. So welcome, Betty Ann. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Amy. Thank you very much for inviting me on your show. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Hopefully I can answer a few questions that some of your listeners may have.
Okay. Okay. And I'm going to give that phone number out. Betty Ann, tell us about yourself. What is your background exactly? I know you have a bachelor's in...
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I'll speak to that for a few minutes.
Go ahead.
As Amy has already mentioned, I'm from Canada, and I graduated from the University of Lethbridge in Alberta with a bachelor's degree in health sciences, specializing in addictions counseling. And it was a wonderful program. I learned so much about myself, my family history, and what it takes to really kind of sit in the client's chair and to understand the process that a client goes through. And with that, I was really inspired and motivated to actually continue further on with addictions counseling. And so once I graduated from university, one of my first real jobs was working with ADAC. And its name has recently changed over the past few years. But ADAC stood for the Alberta Alcohol Drug Association Commission. And I worked in Alberta, and I worked in an outpatient office, outpatient clinic. And by outpatient, I mean the clients in active recovery or looking to quit their addictive behaviors would often come and see an outpatient addictions counselor, which is the role that I fulfilled. And so I worked in a variety of different small towns in central Alberta, as well as a medium-sized city. And I worked for a larger center for about 7-8 years. And then from there, I decided to change my life focus, and I'm doing more psychic readings, mediumship readings, but we can always talk about that at a different time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
When you get your website up, we're going to have you as a guest, you know, and you can help out whenever you wish, so I'd love to have you back. So
absolutely.
The reason why I asked Betty Ann is because her and I have similar backgrounds. We grew up in... how can we say it, addictive households. I'm going to use that term, Betty Ann, as a blanket covering, because addictions can cover anything from sex, drugs, and rock and roll and candy, you know. So
exactly, yeah.
We're going to talk about that. And so, I mean, if you want to center your, you know, if you want to talk about alcohol or to center that, or drugs or whatever you want to call it, but, you know, I wanted to bring Betty Ann on because we talked about codependency a couple weeks ago, and I thought, oh, we'll do something on addictions, and she graciously agreed to come on, you poor thing.
Yeah, no, not a problem. I mean, I worked with a lot of parents and spouses and partners who would be living with someone that they love who's addicted.
Okay.
And
right.
So often you would find that there's a common trait that they often would exhibit those symptoms and characteristics of a codependent. So in itself, they also have their own addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it's actually both individuals or the entire family seeking help. It's just not the addict
mm-hmm.
within the family system, right?
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a moment. You know,
for sure.
Because, you know, when I went to Al-Anon years back, and I resented my family because I'm like, they got the problem. Why do I have to come? And then I you know, went to Phyllis, who when I was in college for my bachelor's too, you know, said, you know, you really were affected by your background, and people don't realize, even though that you live with an alcoholic or drug addict or whatever, that you're very affected. And that's why I did the show on codependency, because a lot of us have some codependent traits from lesser to extreme.
For
to
sure, yes.
So, Betty Ann, we're going to get into the basics of addiction. How would you kind of define addiction for the layman, like, you know, myself, or, you know, not for our listeners out there who are coming in, let's say, they're coming to you, they think they have a problem. How would you define an addiction to them?
Well, I have kind of like a long, drawn out a definition of addiction, but
okay.
For the purposes of time today, I'll just stick to my short version.
Okay. Nope, you're a bridge addiction.
Yeah. Because I find it kind of explains everything, as you said, in layman's terms. But often, you know, during my counseling days, I found that I would basically kind of focus on the long version of addiction, the definition of it. So anyways, my definition of addiction, and based on my professional experiences, I feel that addiction is anything that an individual continues to use any mood-altering substances or any type of behavior despite adverse, or you can call them negative consequences, to the major life areas, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Or it can also be part of a neurological impairment leading to such impulsive behaviors. Like they, you know, depending on a variety of external factors, sometimes there can be a neurological impairment towards addiction, and the person often lacks the ability to control their choices and their impulses.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, that's kind of it's not so clinical, but yet it's almost like an everyday definition of it.
Yes.
Sorry, carry on.
You know, so it's basically you're saying, okay, if I'm, you know, if I'm centering, like, a substance, let's say I'm doing cocaine or I'm doing weed or I'm doing alcohol, and my life is centering around that, and it's causing problems in my life, in all areas of my relationships, my job, would that be another way of kind of seeing it that way?
Exactly, yes. Oh, for sure, that is when... example of explaining it, for sure. Definitely, it's repeated behavior, knowing, you know, that it's not good for you, you know, and it does impact how you live and how you interact with the world around you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's often not in a very positive way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's often in terms of negative consequences, which means, you know, family arguments, your friends no longer want to socialize with you.
Mm-hmm.
It can also affect your ability to do your job or get hired for a job, because most employment places have a drug and alcohol policy where you would have to undergo testing. So it does. It's a repeated pattern, and it does impact your life in all areas.
Okay. Yeah, it does, and it affects every aspect of your life when people really... Well, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And what about those critics that say, alcohol, you can quit anytime you want. You got to force a willpower. You know, if you really want to give it up, you know, you would. And some people will say, well, alcohol, you know, addiction is not a disease. What is your take on that?
My take on that
is addiction a disease, a clinical disease? Some people will say, "Oh no, it's not a disease. It's you know, you can just quit whenever you want. You just got to have enough willpower." you know, I've heard that attitude with some people.
Right, yeah. Yes, and I also heard that as well with some of the parents and spouses during my counseling days in the outpatient clinic. And I often would use those moments as teaching moments because it's a result of lack of proper information and education surrounding addictive behavior. Mm-hmm. And its role in an individual's life and how addiction does work. Mm-hmm. And so in response to your question, mm-hmm. it is not so much considered a disease as in like diabetes or something. It's considered more of a disorder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it would fit under the model of psychosocial biological disorder.
Okay.
And addictive behavior is actually in the DSM-4, mm-hmm. which I do believe that in the U.S. as well, they have this. It's a psychological assessment mm-hmm. tool that is often used by professionals in the mental health field mm-hmm. to diagnose individuals.
Yeah, the diagnostic manual something.
Correct, yes. Yeah, so it's considered more of a disorder than a disease.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. Okay. Well,
mm-hmm. Yes, but it does, you know, it needs to be treated, you know, like mm-hmm. anything that is not healthy for the body or for the mind or for the spirit. So it can be treated, but treatment is long-term,
mm-hmm.
as you know, so from people that you know. And so anyways, my professional opinion when I was a counselor, I often treated it as a disorder. I would look at the different areas in which the addiction impacted the individual and look at how do we treat this
mm-hmm.
in each area.
Okay.
Yes. But, you know, for some people who say, well, you can just quit, you know, well, yeah, they can quit. The difficulty is they don't stay quit. That's the problem. You know what I mean? So
yes, I do. It's like,
you know, it's not a matter of just, oh, okay, yes, I can quit. Mm-hmm. But for some individuals, staying sober or stopping or quitting, that's where the problem lies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a minute. We'll talk about all the aspects of this. I forgot it is a disorder. Now that we've talked about this, yes.
mm-hmm. I mean, individuals perceive disorders and interchange it with the term disease, you know, mm-hmm. but it's really more of a disorder
mm-hmm.
than a disease.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like they call there's personality disorder.
Disorders,
borderline personality disorder. And sometimes I joke those people have no personality. That's why it's a disorder.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
You know.
And other issues along with that.
Yeah, they do. You know, have fun with this topic, Betty Ann, because we do, you know, I like to throw it, because this is a serious topic, but, you know, it's tempered with humor sometimes. People remember it more. But anyway, let's go into more of someone comes to you, and they say, I think I have a problem with I'm not going to use alcohol because I use that in the codependency show. I am a person that has I like cocaine. I'm a crackhead.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm coming to you. How would you assess that person? I'm not saying clinically, but how would you help that person maybe get to where they need to be? And, you know, we'll talk about 12-step programs in a minute, all that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they're coming to you as an addictions counselor, and I'm a crackhead. Or cocaine.
Right. Yeah.
White powdered stuff.
Right.
How
yeah.
would you treat that?
Well, first of all, I would want to know what are the reasons that are motivating this individual to come into an outpatient clinic?
Mm-hmm.
Why are they there today? What brought them into the office today to seek help? Because
mm-hmm.
sometimes, depending on the situation, it can be work-related, right? Because it's impacting that part of their life in a negative way. Or it's related to the legal aspect of life
mm-hmm.
because because they are in trouble with the law. And often their lawyer may be highly suggesting and encouraging that they seek outpatient counseling for their drug behavior. Mm-hmm. So basically, back in the days when I used to be a counselor, I just found that having an initial chat about what really brought you in here today, you know, what are you seeking, how can I help you? Mm-hmm. Because with that, then you get a better idea in terms of where they're at, what's really going on. And then I would just explain, you know, this is what we offer. The general protocol is to do an assessment on you to see how your drug addictive behavior is affecting all of your life areas, and do some testing, drug assessment testing, mm-hmm. to find out, you know, which areas of your impairment, you know, you need to kind of focus on, and then just take it from there. Mm-hmm. Yes. And sometimes people just want to know what are their options. Because some people, you know, want to do outpatient counseling when they first come in for their initial visit. And some people, you know, want to go to an inpatient treatment program. Mm-hmm. So that 1 hour with the individual is a lot of information for anyone who comes in seeking counseling.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's what I would do with them. And then schedule a series of appointments. You know, depending, have they stopped their drug use? If so, how long ago was that? Are they experiencing any type of drug withdrawal symptoms? Mm. Because sometimes if a person is in the active withdrawal stage, that can also motivate them to start using again because they don't want to feel the withdrawal symptoms. And if that's the case, then, you know, we may need to send them to a detox center for a few mm-hmm. days mm-hmm. so they can get proper care and someone to watch them while they withdraw, right? So it's a number of factors that you have to consider during the first initial visit.
Right. So some people, you know, let's say this person, like I said, is crackhead, and maybe the reason why they're in there is because their boyfriend is telling them, well, you stole from me, you know, if you don't get help, I'm going to kick you're out, you know, you're out of here. And maybe that's a wake-up call for them, let's say. What are some of the symptoms, by the way? How do you know that you really have an addiction? Besides, what is with the lying with some of these people? I've heard that time and time again. Is it part of the disorder?
Yes, it is. It is part of the disorder because these individuals have forgotten how to make proper choices in terms of their behavior, because the choices that they made in the past only provided instant gratification mm-hmm. to escape from what their pain is. It can be an emotional pain, a physical pain, a psychological pain of mm-hmm. of some sort. And because of their lack of coping skills and understanding and identifying stressors in their life, they often just revert to what is a quick, easy fix, a form of escaping the pain and escaping any responsibility to find a healthy, effective means to deal with what's really troubling them.
And so I go to you and I say I'm a crackhead and, you know, my boyfriend's going to kick me out because mm-hmm. I stole money from him, blah, blah, blah. But I have really bad withdrawal. So you would suggest right away, there's a difference between some people go to rehab, some people go to outpatient. What is really the difference? Does it depend on the severity of it?
Yes, that's correct. It depends on the severity of it and what they really want to do, because I found often people who came in saying, my boyfriend wants to kick me out because I stole money or I spent my last paycheck on on drugs, and now I have no money to pay for rent. It's often when that's when they're in a crisis state. And so you have to then deal with that immediate crisis as well. Okay, let's problem solve around this. You know, what do you want to do? And look at what, again, motivated them to make such choices. What is really going on in their life? Right? And then you want to present choices to them and help them make the best informed choice based on the situation. If the person comes in under the influence of any drug, it's often best to encourage them to seek some kind of a detox center, a medical facility where they can be watched for a few days. Because you really can't deal with anything if you're going through withdrawal, because you're dealing with the physical withdrawal symptoms and the cravings and everything else that goes along with that. Mm-hmm. And then if they want to go to an inpatient treatment center, often, well, in here in Alberta, you can fill out the application form at the detox center.
Okay.
And then you can go straight into rehab center from there.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And it's often recommended anyway for any individual entering an inpatient treatment program to at least be clean and sober for at least 3 to 5 days.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
And some people can achieve that, but some cannot. And that's where going to a detox center would be beneficial for them before an inpatient treatment program.
Yeah, from what I've heard, it's very physically, the cravings and everything are very physically demanding on the body. And, you know, it's recommended, highly recommended, if you want to get off alcohol or drugs or whatever, that you do seek at least professional help or, you know,
correct.
A physician.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Because you don't know, you know, you get off this crap and then you're like, you know, I know with alcohol, it's very difficult. You know, sometimes it depends on the severity of how much you were drinking. There's a formula. We're not going to go into that, but just
no, that's, yeah.
If anyone's listening to the show and feels like they have a problem and they're thinking about it and it's hitting them upside the head, then go to your physician and get checked out for sure. And, you know, and then we're going to, okay, so we'll kind of walk through what a patient would go through. So they go through the inpatient detox, they're in rehab for 28 days or whatever, 30 days. They come out and, you know, it's suggested they go to outpatient mm-hmm. and everything. What are some of the tools that you would, let's go to now the person has decided that they want to get sober or they want to have a cleaner life, you know, without alcohol or drugs. What is the next process here? Let's talk about some support groups out there. And
right. If the individual successfully completed an inpatient treatment program, then it's often part of their recovery plan is to continue in some form of an outpatient clinic mm-hmm. to seek additional counseling on issues that they still want to explore and problem solve around. And a lot of, I know where I live, a lot of inpatient treatment clinics have a variety of different groups, like psychosocial groups in terms of, you know, how do you manage your leisure time? How do you communicate in a healthy manner? How do I build a healthy sense of self-esteem? Handling emotions. Handling cravings, just very useful topics and information that will help them with their recovery program. Mm-hmm. And I can only speak from my experience in Canada, in Alberta where I live, that often when clients come out of an inpatient treatment center, they often have a recovery plan already drawn up that they made before leaving the treatment center, and they would bring it in with them mm-hmm. for outpatient counseling. And we would look over, you know, what they created, what, you know, just really explore, you know, some of the reasons why they picked this and want to do that. And just to reinforce the recovery plan, to make it more tangible, to make it sound like something that they can implement in their everyday living. Because now they're going to be returning to their community, to their neighborhood, to the family, and now they have all of these tools and they absorbed all this information and worked through some of their stuff, which, you know, when they leave, they're still, it's all still overwhelming. So that is why it's often recommended to go to an outpatient clinic. And so anyways, the client would come to me, we'd look at his recovery plan and find out if there's anything they want to add to it, or after they look at it, they realize, no, I want to delete this from that. You know, so we really, you know, examine their recovery plan again. And if attending groups is something that they want to do at the outpatient clinic, then I would encourage them to start doing that. If they want to start attending 12-step groups in the area like AA or Narcotics Anonymous or gambling or something associated to the 12-step, then we would work with that as well in terms of their personal schedule. Mm-hmm. And often these individuals, you know, will not be working, or they've taken time out from work to really focus on their recovery plan. And so with that, you want to really continue building on to that solid foundation that they started while they're in an inpatient treatment center.
Yeah, because usually these individuals coming out, their life revolved around the substance. And
correct.
So now it's like, I have to rebuild my life. And it is overwhelming because you have to get to know yourself again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very traumatic for some of these individuals. And sometimes, you know, they're just like, okay, what do I do with myself? You know, I used to drink 20 hours out of 24 or whatever it was, or I used to, you know, go on binges. And so with that, what is it like with your patients? Was it hard for a lot of them to rebuild their lives after maybe being an active addiction or active disorder?
Well, I would be lying if I said no, not at all. But yes, they the majority of them did find it overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, that means that the people that they used to hang out with, they can no longer do that. Places that they used to go, it's not recommended that they just go and check things out,
mm-hmm.
because then they're still in the high stages of relapse, right? So you really want to encourage them not to go down memory lane or fool themselves into thinking, well, I can still hang out with them and not use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, that doesn't last very long, because then with peer pressure, and then you get the cravings, and then if you're still new to recovery, it's very hard to resist the cravings.
Mm-hmm.
And then the memories come flooding back, and then you just, oh, well, I could just do it just once. So it's not recommended that they try to reconnect with the people that they used to hang out with prior to treatment program.
Okay.
So, I can't remember what your question was. Sorry.
That's okay. No, that's, you know, rebuilding their lives. And when we talk about relapse, how come some people are more prone to relapse than other people? You kind of mentioned it, touched on it, but, you know, going to places and people and things, which they would tell you to avoid.
Yes. Yes, it's often recommended to avoid that. But recovery basically is a process about change, right?
Mm-hmm.
Change in terms of how the addicted person sees, feels, processes, and communicates to themselves and with others around them. And by others, that can mean a spouse, children, family members, coworkers. Okay? So it's a change in a lifestyle, a change in the behaviors, a change, just an overall change from something into something that they've never imagined
mm-hmm.
in their life. So that in itself, that realization can be very overwhelming. And often why relapse occurs is because they were not working, implementing, living their recovery program in the early stages of any addictive recovery. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's easy to become complacent about being aware of their emotions, being aware of, are they physically tired? Are they hungry? Are they angry at something? You know, so it's easy to fall back into what you know than to actively work at your recovery plan. Mm-hmm. And not asking for help when mm-hmm. the cravings become overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, yeah, you were talking about the hungry, angry, lonely, tired, the HALT they have it.
Correct,
in,
yes.
In the HALT program. Yeah, in the mm-hmm. 12-step program. If you ask yourself those questions, usually there's a trigger in there somewhere. You know, and that's where recovery comes in. It helps you to identify those triggers and what maybe, you know, what you got to really look at why you drank or why you drugged
that's
in the
right.
first
yes.
place.
Yeah, like definitely triggers. What are those triggers for the individual? You know, and to be constantly aware of them. Mm-hmm. And if it means driving a different route to go home instead of driving past your old drinking hole, then that's what you need to do. You know, because it's about not allowing just even the visualization to see the place of old haunts to come into the forefront of your mind, because then it's difficult to shake it. So if that means going a different route home from work for a while, then you do that, mm-hmm. right? And if triggers, like for some people, seeing old, like their old hangout buddies is a trigger, you know? And often these buddies may be hanging out at their old drinking haunt or wherever you engaged in addictive behavior, right? So it's really about becoming completely aware of your past behaviors and how can you find a way to cope with that.
Mm-hmm. So now let's go into the support groups. There's AA is capitalized on the 12
yes.
step, but there's
mm-hmm.
other programs. But let's talk a little bit about AA. What has been your, you know, what is the premise of AA? Where, you know, where does that come in and so on?
Well, I found that many people used AA as part of their recovery plan. That's just one of many groups that they would attend. And, you know, depending on the outpatient clinic that you go to, they can also have their own support groups in the mornings, at lunchtime, or in the evening. So a lot of people like to add variety to the recovery program and not just focus on AA. But if AA is something that a person just wants to do, that is fine too. I found that recommending my clients to go to AA early in recovery was very helpful in terms of being surrounded by others who have been there,
mm-hmm.
who understand what you're going through and can offer sound advice, insight, and wisdom in terms of this is what worked for me, this didn't work for me, you know, and also to compliment the individual as well, you know, because sometimes those in recovery are very hard on themselves and their self-esteem is already low. So, you know, for them to hear positive feedback from others who have been in the same place and are kind of a little further along in the road of recovery, it's often comforting for mm-hmm. that particular individual to hear, you're doing the right thing. You keep going. Don't give up. You know,
mm-hmm.
you be proud of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for some of my clients, they found AA totally helpful, and they lived the philosophy of AA and worked through the steps, and they made a lot of new connections.
Mm-hmm.
So that in itself worked. And, you know, so they would continue using AA for their benefit to be clean and sober.
Mm-hmm.
And for other individuals, they found AA or any other 12-step useful for the early stages of their recovery program.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that, well, you you know, I found with my clients that they would go as long as they got what they needed. And when they felt, you know, it wasn't serving a purpose anymore, then they would maybe try a different type of meeting at a different time with different group members, or just realize I've gotten what I needed out of the group. You know, so being in active recovery often means to always revamp, recreate your recovery plan, because recovery is lifelong. It just doesn't last 3 to 6 months. It's constant.
But there's some other groups out there, too, and I want to get this name out there for Women for Sobriety, because I know of a couple friends of mine that really are obsessed with that. How is that different from a 12-step program?
Well, Women
for Sobriety and or SRS or Smart Recovery, those are some. I'm sorry, I'm just putting some out there.
Right. Well, where I lived in medium-sized city, Women for Sobriety was only offered in a bigger center, like in Calgary or in Edmonton. And so where I lived, unfortunately, a lot of the women who wanted to access that couldn't go because of the distance. But, you know, I have heard good things about Women for Sobriety. I can't really speak to that because I don't think it's as common in Canada as it is in the U.S.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about those individuals, let's say they're isolated or they're in areas, so like you said, they're not in near the big metropolitan cities, maybe they don't have access to AA or Women for Sobriety. A lot of people have found success with the online, you know, Women for Sobriety I know has a very good support group, so does Smart Recovery. What is your opinion on that? Can you recover with online tools?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, for sure. You know, with the age of technology and, you know, people living in small towns, you can access AA, Women for Sobriety, and a number of different 12-step groups online and become an active member. As long as the individual is committed to still doing the work, you know, I would still consider that just as useful as going to a meeting and being there in person.
You know, sometimes your schedule doesn't permit it, or sometimes...
That's correct, yes. You know, with people's working schedules, lack of transportation, and if you live in a small town or it's just not feasible for you to attend, well, sure, why not? You know, so as long as the person is committed to still do the work and be totally honest when they actively participate on the board, then I don't see why a person cannot engage in that type of attendance, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, physical.
Yeah.
Because sometimes people will say, you're not going to a meeting, you know, isn't that, you're not in your recovery program. And sometimes online is just as good, if not better, than going to, you know, to an active, to a personal, to meeting, you know, personally or face-to-face group or whatever you want to call it. But there's so many groups out there that, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. And it just doesn't need to be only AA. Again, depending on what other issues the individual is working on, it can be, you know, family therapy groups, individual psychological groups such as anger management or anything like that. That's part of their recovery program because, you know, it's just not focusing on, oh, I've stopped using, I've stopped drinking. But it's also looking at, well, how do I still deal with these issues?
Right, instead of going to the bottle or snorting up the Coke or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, there's a variety in different ways, in addition to just attending AA, that a person can also make their recovery plan dynamic and not boring, because I know some individuals, some of my clients, you know, they found their recovery plan boring after a while, and that's why I said earlier it's always important to revamp your recovery plan as you move along your recovery path.
Yeah, and you also want to, you know, discover things in recovery, especially with my side in Al-Anon. I discovered a lot of things about myself. I found out about myself, who I was as a person. And I think that recovery can serve its purpose in that way, too. The addict has to get to know it's him or herself.
Correct,
and,
yes.
You know, life actually can be great, you know, from what I've heard from people who have sober lives for many years. And
that's right, yes.
It's almost like a new lease on life for them. So let's go to maybe family members that have a loved one that is an active addiction, or what they call active addiction.
Mm-hmm.
How would you advise them if they came to you, Betty Ann, and said, you know what, I think my husband or my boyfriend is an alcoholic. How would you try to help them? Because sometimes they'll go, I've noticed even with my own clients, you know, say, I went to the addictions counselor, and they said, I have a problem too. You want to address that for us?
Yeah, sure. Where I worked, I created and co-facilitated an evening group for those who love an addict. And it was basically a group where spouses and parents can come together and really learn about what an addiction is, how the addictive cycle works, what is relapse, just a lot of education and information that I found that a lot of these individuals who attended these groups did not know. And then, you know, it was also about teaching them as well new coping skills, because these individuals would just become extremely reactive when that loved one was using. Like, it became to the point that they forgot to live their own life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the codependent.
And they put all their focus, all of their energies onto the person who has the addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So that in itself creates a very toxic dynamic. And when you say to all of these members, you know, it's because you've been living like this for so long that you've forgotten about your own life.
Mm-hmm.
And they think, well, if the addict would just stop and get better, then I can focus on my life, which does not work. And in fact, the opposite, it's the exact opposite. You put the focus back on your own life and worry less about the addictive one, you will realize that bit by bit, then they will slowly want to change their own addictive behavior. But it really means that these parents and partners really need to look at, well, how does my behavior serve my purpose? You know, and that's where the codependency would come in as well. So it really is a toxic dance. In you know, within partnerships and within families.
Exactly. And, you know, people will say, okay, let's say their loved one does get sober, or what they call sobriety, living the life of sobriety. You know, and it's like, it's almost like a new set of problems cropped up, you know. And I've noticed with my own clients, I have a client that I feel sorry for this person because their partner has given up, you know, the drugs, and it's like this person doesn't know what to do with themselves. And, you know, I've suggested Al-Anon or some other support group. And why do you think that is? It's like now they don't have the fires to put out, right, that they can't.
Correct. Yeah.
You know? And it's almost, and the other, you know, because the partner who has sobered up, you know, is maybe going to AA meetings and going outpatient and really focusing on getting better themselves, if they make that commitment to recovery. And I feel that recovery is a commitment, whether
it
you're
is.
On
I
one
agree
end
with you.
Or the
it
other.
Is. It is a commitment. It's either you do it or you don't. There's no such thing as, oh, I'm only going to commit half-heartedly to it. Well, that's why relapse happens. Either you are fully committed or you're not to recovery. But definitely, you know, I found that a lot of parents and a lot of spouses would find it difficult to be around the person who is in active recovery, working their program, you know, creating their life circle, their wheel of life a little bit more healthy, and they're actively working towards that, you know. And the reason why they have such difficulty with that, I mean, yes, they're happy that addictive loved one is on to the road of recovery, their life is getting back to normal, and it's because they themselves have forgotten how to live. They have forgotten what they like to do. They've forgotten about their own friends and family, and because the entire time, all of their energy was put onto the person with the addiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so then it's... I found that a lot of parents and spouses who come to that realization get mad at themselves because... Mm-hmm. You know, it goes either one or two ways. They're like, yeah, okay, well, I can get back to me now. You know, why am I still wasting my energy on this person? You know, when they're really busy with their own life. And even the addictive one would be saying, don't you think it's time for you to get your own life now?
Yeah, no. Really, get a life is right.
You know? Yeah, basically, that's what it comes down to. You get a life now. Like, you know, but then some individuals, because they don't want to admit that they're codependent, they, you know, they may not be as supportive as they want to be to the addictive loved one, because if that one, that addictive loved one relapses or something like that, then everybody falls back into their regular roles again. Then life is good, you know, so it's predictable. You know, so it can go one or two ways, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes when you become sober, if you're the addictive personality, a lot of times, you know, your relationships break up because...
That's right, yes.
Which is common, and it's not. It's a 50-50, I think, out there. But it all depends.
It does happen, for sure, yeah. Yeah, and if, it, for example, if the one in recovery realizes... My family's not healthy. They're not willing to become healthy. Look at their issues. I'm tired of always being the scapegoat. You know, that person may cut them off
mm-hmm.
of association because, you know, they can be a big trigger for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really difficult to be around someone who is actively working at making their life more positive and becoming healthier when their family of origin is still unhealthy and still operating from dysfunctional behaviors. So, you know, a lot of people will make that conscious choice to go, this doesn't work for me. I can't be around my family because of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they find it too stressful, too toxic, and sometimes it's just not worth the time or energy.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, yeah, and then you got some counselors out there or therapists that say, well, you know, you've got to get back to your family of origin. I joke, I call it my foo. You know?
Exactly, the foo, yes. Yes, and some people will de-foo, you know, and that is perfectly okay. You know, you have to do what's best for you to be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And if the family of origin is not going to go into family therapy and look at their own issues within that system, then it's really hard to relate to them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and sometimes if there's unresolved issues of abuse, or,
correct.
You know,
yes.
Some people drink or drug because their family of origin was not that nice to grow up with. And,
exactly.
And it's called denial. It's not the river in Egypt. You know, it is true denial. If these people are continually, like, you know, like June Cleaver on crack, you know, you got to do what you have to do. And people feel guilty about that. Well, this is my mother, this is my father, this is my sister, this is my brother, or this is my, you know, whatever. Sometimes you just need to back away and say, look, I can't deal with you. Even if you have to back away for a long period of time, and, you know, you may or have to cut off your contact altogether, which I know some people that have done that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I had clients who did that as well. And yes, it's not an easy choice to make. And yes, they do feel guilty, but that's because they're, you know, they've placed a boundary. They're practicing how to do that and stand behind that boundary to keep themselves healthy. So, you know, often guilt comes from staying true to yourself and respecting the boundaries you place.
Mm-hmm.
And so after, you know, the client absorbs all of the choices that they made to make their world healthier and cleaner, you know, then they realize I needed to do this for myself to keep my own sanity, so I don't need to continue being faced with that toxicity within the family system.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, yes, families are not going to like that,
mm-hmm.
right? Because then you move away, you become healthy, and they stay exactly where they're at.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And sometimes it's really sad because if you, let's say, you extricated yourself from your foo for a while, you're in recovery, maybe you're working on your sobriety or, your recovery plan, and then you go back into that and you're, like, looking at them like, oh, my God, these people are whacked, It's okay for you to back away again. It's okay to do whatever you need, to thine own self be true, as they say in AA. Some people, they'll say to thine own self be true. If it doesn't, you have to live with yourself. And if it doesn't feel right for you, then you need to back away.
That's okay to do. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. And if that's part of your recovery plan, so you stay clean and sober, then yes, that's what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And how they react, that's their stuff.
Mm-hmm. So, you made a commitment to stay in recovery, and no matter what, you had to really, your recovery, as I was told from a member of AA a long time ago, that's the most important part of it. I mean, I think, your higher power is or God or whatever, but, that's your important base is to stay sober, is that, how can I put this? I'm trying to articulate the words. Your sobriety is the cornerstone of your life. Let's say it that way. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I would agree with that. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. It's a lifelong commitment. It's a process of change because it's always going to be changing. And you just don't stop after a year of sobriety with your recovery. You keep going. And like I said earlier, you keep adding things to your recovery plan, and you can also take things away, because as you grow deeper within yourself and get to know yourself and you move further along in your recovery plan, you realize some things just no longer serve their purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. So then you replace it with something else that will keep your recovery plan fresh and somewhat challenging, because you don't want to fall into a rut with your recovery plan.
Mm-hmm.
You always want to keep it, like I said, fresh, and keep it so that it challenges you enough, but doesn't overwhelm you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So any advice, while we're wrapping up the show here, buddy, and any advice to people that may feel they have an addiction, what's the first step?
Well, the first step definitely is to admit that you do have a problem, and to fully say that to yourself, I have a problem, and then to say, I want to get the help, and to be open to receiving that help. And it's okay to say, because I've heard a lot of my clients, first time they admitted they really needed the help, and now they're seeking the help, to say, I'm scared. And it's okay to say that. It's okay to say, I'm scared. I'm scared to ask for help. I feel ashamed that I have to ask for help. But, that's what you need to do. And that's perfectly okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, for those of your listeners, anyone who feels ready to make the change, I would definitely, I don't know what the process is in the U.S. or in the area that you live in, but if there's outpatient clinics, a mental health clinic, or even talk to your family doctor to ask for any recommendations or referrals, a treatment center, detox, definitely be open to finding the services that you need, and do not be afraid to ask for help.
And there's the phone book too. Look under alcohol or drug treatment or AA. Go on.
AA, call AA. They generally will have phone numbers that you can call if you're really serious about, seeking the help that you need from your addiction.
Well, I think we're going to wrap this up, Betty Ann. I really appreciate you coming in. This was a very informative hour. It was really good.
Yes.
I appreciate
my pleasure.
It. And maybe we'll do some more shows, maybe on ACOA, topics and all that wonderful stuff. Then we'll really get into the meat of things.
Yeah, exactly. Angels and mediumship.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, I just want to say thank you very much for the invite. I very much enjoyed the past hour. I didn't realize that time flew by, and
yes.
It did. And
mm-hmm.
So I hope the information today, you know, will help some of your listeners.
Yes, I'm sure it will. Well, you have a great day, and I'll talk with you soon. Have a
Absolutely.
Great day. Angels be with you. Bye-bye.
Yes, you too. Thank you. Bye-bye.